Hi, everyone. I guess it's time, so welcome. My name is Gerardo Marty, and I'm a sociology professor at Davidson College in North Carolina. I'm also have been a pastor for quite a while before that, and before I was a pastor, I was a graduate student in sociology. So I've had a kind of an interesting pathway, and in terms of my experience with multiracial, multi-ethnic churches, I've either been a part of one or been studying them for probably 11 or 12 years now. I'm one of, if you don't mind my saying so, my wife doesn't like me to brag, but I'm one of a handful of what are experts on what's happening in multiracial churches in America, and that's not saying much, and it's simply because we don't know a lot. There are a lot of opinions out there, and everybody here has them. And if there's something that I can easily find is that everybody thinks they know something about diversity in churches and how to promote that. And so, between this session and the next session, I'm going to offer you a lot of information. I hope in a way that's helpful, but also might be provocative. Things that you might know and things that you might not know at all. I may also threaten some of the things that you think you know. And so the good thing is that after this session, I understand there's lunch, and I would enjoy conversation with you, especially if you've had experience in a multiracial, multi-ethnic church. I'd be very eager for dialogue about your context, your situation. But this session and next session is going to offer you some insights that I think come from actual observation. One of the things that I found among church leaders, I remember a pastor who said, if you plant one church, you're an expert. And I think that Welcome. And I think that this happens a lot with diversity in churches. If you've been a part of one church that's diverse, you're an expert. And I can tell you that there are a lot of people, I don't know if you're in this room, don't tell me if you are, but there are a lot of people making a lot of money as consultants on diversity. And I need to get in on that gig, you know. So, I'll give you my card. But there are a lot of people who are based on very little information, have a lot of opinion. Or based on a lot of Bible study, have even more opinion, you know. And so what I am is I'm a sociologist, and that means that I've actually gone and observed. I've written two books on multiracial churches, not always talking about the issues that you're most interested in. But there are two books out there. The first one is already out, called A Mosaic of Believers. It is the first in-depth study of a multi-ethnic church. It's about a church called Mosaic in Los Angeles. The second book is about a church in Hollywood, a black-white church in Hollywood, and the issue of diversity is addressed there, but in the context of people who are together working for making it in the entertainment industry. And there's a lot of reasons as to why that's important, and that I call Hollywood Faith, and that'll be out in the summer. I'm in the midst of writing two more books, both of them centered on worship in multiracial churches. One I intend to be more social scientific in nature in terms of dealing with issues and questions about worship and church and race. And another one geared more towards church leaders and practitioners about the advice literature, a lot of advice that you're being given, some of which I think you can find support for, but for other things I think not. So that's a broad introduction. Happy for questions. Let's see where we go. All right. In terms of what I did, this is just a lot of stuff. This is more for me. Race and Church 101. 94% of churches are one race or ethnicity. Okay, that's church in a broad sense. That includes, we should really say congregations. It includes synagogues, mosques, any form of religious gathering, about 94%. If it's Protestant churches, actually, it's about 95 or 96% of Protestant churches. And the more conservative the church, that appears to go up a little bit more. So homogeneity is the standard. And this is part of why I want to be very cautious with people who are very passionate out there who say, you must be diverse in order to be biblical. If that is true, then 95% of our churches are not biblical. Yes, sir.
If you have one prism of another race.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And you put that person on your brochure and website, too. Right? That's right. That's right. I was at a church in Ohio, but, you know, I think you've already seen it. Social science uses a marker of 20%, 20% of the congregation being different from the majority group. And it's based on a social psychological schema that if you have at least 20%, then every person will have regular contact with someone who is of a different race or ethnicity. And we're talking about different. You know, it's not like two people came from two different neighborhoods in the Netherlands. You know, it's not about, you know, or the person who speaks Dutch and the person who doesn't, right? So we're not talking about that. We're talking about significant differences to the extent that that's possible. And so there's a lot to talk about. Boy, this could be a big conversation in and of itself, but I really appreciate that you've asked the most important question, which is that the bar is set at 20%. I thought that was very low. Okay, but then I was shocked that when you set the bar even at that point, you still come up with that number. Okay, and by the way, I'm not talking about churches that rent their facilities to other congregations. I'm not talking about the multi-service church. I'm not talking about the multi-site church. I'm not talking about places that, you know, are able to generate a little bit of income by being able to have a number of different people. We're talking about in the same services, in the same congregation, a part of the same fellowship. So, with that, churches indeed may be the most segregated institutions in society today. I think you know this. And what makes it problematic? Well, first of all, it conflicts with our understanding of the church as a place of love, acceptance, and hospitality. I think you know that. And it scares us to believe that our churches are based on racial prejudice or discrimination. And that's why I want to be cautious. Again, 94% of churches are homogeneous. So we need to be cautious in saying that just because your church does not have diversity does not automatically mean that it is based on racial prejudice or discrimination. And what we need to do is sophisticate ourselves about a number of things, and part of it is intentionality. Sociologists differ. There's just a little bit of controversy. All of us participate in white dominant culture in the United States. And in that sense, we are all a part of the institutionalized racism that occurs in this country. Now, I have a class that discusses this for an entire semester. Here, I'm just going to make it as a comment. So in some sense, we all participate in the institutionalized racism of the nation. But that does not necessarily mean, I think on a moral perspective, I would say it doesn't necessarily mean that each one of our churches is inherently racist. And that's something that I think we have to really carefully look at. Because there are subtle issues to work through about are we actually discriminatory in our behavior and what can we do about that? Or is it that the possibilities are more limited where we are or how we accomplish those things? So you can see I'm starting to hedge. All right, my expertise is melting away right now. Race, church, and society. All right. Listen, certain churches consist of specific racial and ethnic societies. All right, so the group's religion is an adjunct of a particular cultural life. Think of Irish Catholics, Scottish Presbyterians, or Dutch Reformed. We might have a few around here. And the unity of belief and practice often means shared cultural practices are inherited from racial and ethnic distinctives. And this is the thing that's hard to know. Our churches inevitably are embedded in particular cultural patterns and practices. How do you know that they're there? Whew, that's tough. Because, as I've said many times, fish don't know they live in the water. It's very hard for us to be aware of the base assumptions that operate in how we live our communal lives. It's very hard to tell. And that's where immersive experiences in other cultures, having people come in as a consultant. It's very hard for us to do that. And this is what sociologists, I think, are particularly good at trying to get at, is looking at those things. So even on a casual level, we recognize that blacks from West Africa have incorporated particular cultural practices in the same way that Lutherans from Minnesota incorporate other cultural practices. All right, so here's the key insight. The practice of a religion is never disentangled from the practice of a culture. And let me tell you that this is like cutting edge sociology stuff. I mean, if you want to really like go into a conference and show off, you know, just say, you know, culture's not a belief, culture's a practice, and you'll go, you'll have a lot of you know, that kind of thing. It's a very good academic talk. And what we mean by that is that sociologists are very good at saying, we can't assume that culture is the airy, uncertain kind of ideas that emerge from a culture, from a people, or from a group. It's not the ideas, the concepts, it's not just like the kind of food they eat or the colors that they prefer. That culture is actually in the practice, and it's embedded in what we actually do. So culture as practice is a critical aspect of getting a more sophisticated understanding of what's happening in our churches. All right. So believers often insist that their way to worship and practice in a congregational life is the most proper and divinely sanctioned way. I'm sure no one here believes that. But I need to say it, okay? And so this is where we have to say that the entanglement means that many of us think that worship is a particular way. And it gets worse, because we tend to think of worship as atemporal, that it exists outside of time. Worship is quite ethnocentric. You know, we tend to think that our way of worship is the best and the proper way. Those things get us into trouble. And so the way we begin the path of sophisticating ourselves is to say, guess what? Worship is time-bound. It's historically developed. It's socially embedded. You know, those kinds of things. And once we are willing to do that, then we're open to some surprises. All right. The great assumption about race and ethnicity in congregational life is assimilation. What do we mean by that? This is the belief that ethnic and racial groups gradually shed their religious specifics and mold into the dominant American religious middle. Sometimes I think this is what churches imply when they rent their facilities. Okay, so there's a church that I know of in L.A. The actual church holds, I think it's 1,200 or 1,400 people. Guess how many members there are in this church? There are 80 active members of this church. They're all white, okay? They rent their facility to 8 different congregations. The congregations are either more diverse than them or are of a different race or ethnicity, all right? And it starts as early as 8 o'clock in the morning. There's Saturday, and then there's even midweek. People like to go to church generally at around what time? 10 o'clock on Sunday morning. Guess who gets that 10 o'clock slot? They get the 10 o'clock slot, right? They are the smallest congregation of all the congregations that meet there. And why do they do that? It is a revenue-generating business idea. I mean, really, it's a business idea. But what I think is going on is that I think that people go, you know, let's give them this because it's temporary. Eventually, they'll fit. You know, they'll come. Maybe some will come. They see it as a strategy of church growth, but also a strategy of fitting into the middle. We give people who are not of the dominant group the marginalized times in the expectation that as they grow up, they will become more mainstream and more of the middle. And I want to tell you that this assumption is so pervasive that it's largely unspoken, and you have to stand outside of yourself to go, gosh, they're just assuming that everybody's going to eventually be like us. And that's a very dangerous assumption. So each successive generation is the idea that they Americanize and adopt whatever religious practices are already in practice. So the strategy is just wait. Hold on to your tradition. So, the holding on of traditions, I think, is not just based on a belief in tradition. I think it's a belief that this is just the way it should be. Everybody will learn. And as they learn, they'll come in, eventually. All right. It doesn't work. Non-white groups do not neatly fit into our idealized American melting pot. And this demands on us understanding some of the 20th century history. Irish, French, English, and German heritages reflect immigration policies that happened at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. Now, you need to know something about this because this is helpful to you. Immigration policies of the United States were not neutral. They were deliberate, and they reflected lighter-skinned races from north of the equator. Okay, and this is part of the eugenics movement. Do you know the eugenics movement? Oh, a good little Google on eugenics will do you so much good. The eugenics movement was the belief that there was a genetic superiority among certain peoples of the world. And so we think of Nazis when you think of that, but the ideas were actually in the United States well before Nazism, and they were in practice. We decided that we were going to have certain groups come into the United States and not others because there was a rank order of who tended to be more criminal, who tended to be more insane, you know, to go mentally as insane, who had better hygiene, all of these things. And there were sophisticated tables that were done at the time, even including things like skull size and all those kind of really weird things. But the symptomatic thing was color of skin. So the color of skin was directly related to intelligence, what made a good American citizen, what would build a strong nation, political motives. And so the eugenics movement moved into what our immigration policies is, and so the reason why we have people who are quite proud of being immigrants but have also fit into our American way of life is that it was sort of jerry-rigged that way. These were people who were already supposed to fit in well. I don't want to minimize the conflicts that happened in the early 20th century because we know that there were ethnic conflicts. We don't remember them anymore, between the Irish and the German fighting for factory work and other kinds of things, Chicago, other places like that. But those things were still real. They assimilated fairly quickly. The Chinese and the Japanese immigrants, for example, who were already in this country, were systematically denied American citizenship. And in fact, gosh, not enough time. But basically, the Supreme Court had to rule several times. One most notable case about whether a Japanese man was white. Citizenship was based on race. And so people had to go to court to argue whether they were white or not. And by being denied being white, they were denied citizenship. So Chinese and Japanese who have been here longer or as long as these groups certainly have not fit into the American middle. And that gives us pause to think about how assimilation works. So as ethnic groups grew, non-white groups assimilated into their own religious congregations. What a surprise! And of course we know this, because churches are where marginal groups care for themselves and work through survival in a white dominant culture. The most famous example is the black church. And we see that still repeated again and again today. In 1965... immigration policies were changed in the United States, and that favored not only an opening of the borders, but particularly for Southeast Asia. And that's when we had Koreans, and particularly we noticed Koreans, Japanese, Chinese, and other groups have come in. And so now we're experiencing these very interesting phenomena, the Asian church, but also pan-Asian churches, Asians that mix. So that you have Japanese and Chinese perhaps mixed together. And then we have the lot of literature coming out right now about second Korean Asians, particularly second generation Korean. A lot of interesting literature there. I know several experts just on that who've written about that. So this helps us, again, to see how worship works. All right, so what's the challenge of diversity today? All right, since the 1960s, we have the successes and continued challenges of the civil rights movement. We have the changes in the 1965 immigration laws, which I've mentioned. Changes in the legality of interracial marriage, beginning in Virginia and moving on. That provokes not only interracial, interethnic couples, but the issue of blended race among children. Changes of mortgage lending and sales of homes. I'm sure you've heard you may not have, of redlining, but essentially that there was systematic practices of keeping people in particular arenas of a city. And so because neighborhoods for many years was the way in which churches were organized, the segregation of housing had a dramatic effect on the homogenization of churches. You follow that? And that continues today. So even though we still have some loosening of that, you still have some very important work being done on housing that shows that segregation is still an extremely important phenomenon even in cities that you would consider diverse, like Los Angeles, Chicago, and New York. So the racial segregation has a direct effect on historic development of neighborhood churches, and the heritage of that is something that we continue to have today. All right. So, and then we now have immigration issues, particularly from Latin America, and that's prompting a number of other interesting issues. One that I'm most interested in and will start pursuing is Spanish churches. You know, a little sign that says Spanish church here, the Spanish church 2 o'clock. That's the phenomenon I'm interested in right now. All right, so that's why we're all interested in diversity right now. So the turn of the 21st century, we have an increased value for diversity, and that's kind of nice, right? Everybody thinks it's good. There aren't very many people you'll find who, and they won't say it out loud, okay? So you also have a disdain for racial discrimination. Remember Don Imus, right? Got kicked off the radio. And we have an increased sensitivity to racial prejudice. So these are all the things that are leading churches to pay attention. So we now look at our churches and wonder what's happening in our backyard. All right, so that's why you're here. All right. One of the things that I also want to mention is the rejection of the homogeneous unit principle. Are you aware of this? Well, if you're not aware of it, it's kind of interesting because 10 years ago, this workshop would have been about the homogeneous unit principle. The homogeneous unit principle is the most important church growth principle of the 30, 40 years. It is what established and fueled the church growth movement. The homogeneous unit principle was a strategy for church growth. It grew out of the work of Donald McGavran, and then C. Peter Wagner really took off with it, both of them at Fuller Seminary. And and the core insight is racial and ethnic homogeneity allows for a targeting of ministry. All right. So Donald McGavran wrote this book, and it was not in the United States. It had to do with missionary work in less developed countries, right? Which already we have very different societal circumstances. And his essential thing was we are intent on converting entire groups of people rather than just individuals. And by being able to shape the ministry in a particular way, we would be able to gear the ministry to stimulate mass conversions, group-based conversions. And so it's developed in less developed world. That's a funny word. And my editor would go, and then it was adopted in the U.S. As a marketing scheme, because the idea of marketing fit in very nicely with this idea of homogeneity. And that's where you have Saddleback Sam. You know, that's Rick Warren started to create a profile. And so for many years, the question in every church conference was, who's your target? Who's your target? And mega churches grew by having places for different targets. And so I think it was Carl George that started to conceive of the church as having multiple doors. And so those multiple doors were multiple, places of connection. And so those kinds of things. So to me, the most interesting thing about this radical move towards racial and ethnic diversity in churches is that overwhelmingly, the American church is rejecting the homogeneous unit principle. And I consider that a significant earthquake in paradigm for how churches are structured. So we have made a dramatic shift. All right. Oasis. Let me tell you a little bit about a church that I've written. It's coming out this summer. It's a black-white church, 45%. And it started black-white. It started in the home of a Hollywood producer with an Oscar on the mantle and everything. And what's interesting here is that this church began and sustains itself with a sensitivity to African-American issues. Okay, so the interesting thing here is that they decided to be very upfront about race. Okay, they decided to be very clear that we're not going to be blind about racial issues. We're going to talk about them. We're going to preach about them, and we're going to incorporate it in every aspect of our ministry. All right. Now, Mosaic, which is the first book that I wrote, it's called The Mosaic of Believer. It's not available at the bookstore. That's not true. Either that or all of them sold out. I don't think that they got any. But the church is one-third white, one-third Hispanic, and one-third Asian. Right. The question became, why are there blacks at Oasis, but there are no blacks at Mosaic? Okay? On the other hand, if you'll notice, Here we have white, Hispanic, and Asian, whereas the other doesn't have very many Hispanics or Asians. All right, let me tell you one insight that we can immediately say here. When you say multiracial, guess what? You're not saying anything at all. The label multiracial, multi-ethnic, only means you have the presence of at least one other group that's different from the dominant group. That's it. So the first thing, your first kind of another nugget to give you, is that you should be extremely cautious about anyone who pretends to tell you anything that's true about all multiracial churches. Because what we're dealing with here is we don't know anything about the size, we don't know anything about the intentionality, the region of the country, we don't know anything about denominational backgrounds, we don't know if they really tried to do it or if it happened somehow accidentally, we don't know if it's a church that's new or old, we don't know anything. You have to learn to ask a lot more questions. And that's why I'm really always excited to talk to people who've had experiences in a multiracial church, because I am learning just like you. There are precious few things that we really know, and my work is an attempt to get at that. All right. The difference between Mosaic and Oasis. Let me start with Mosaic first. At Mosaic, I talked about something called havens, and this is important because havens becomes a very interesting concept to work with. A haven is a place of refuge. It's a place where you feel connection. It's a place that you're comfortable with. How are havens created? Well, when I talked to people at Mosaic, everyone had experience with the church. Okay, very few people in the world have had no experience with the church. Right? Unchurched is a misnomer, right? When we call it, this is a church for the unchurched, what we mean is you can come in jeans and shorts and nobody will be upset, right? So it's really a lot, it says a lot more than that, than just the people here who have no idea of church. People have experiences with church. At Mosaic, everyone has had a bad experience with church. Every person has had a negative experience with church. And so what was interesting is then Mosaic reflected something that they didn't like about other churches, and it also reflected something that appreciated something they had a value for, okay? Something they appreciated. And I walked through this in a lot of ways, but the first one is a fresh theology. Mosaic in Los Angeles is led by Irwin McManus. He's written many now best-selling books, right? Irwin, a friend of mine. And so the church does talk about orthodox theology. I mean, it believes in Jesus, the Bible, you know, those kinds of things. But when you go, it doesn't sound like that. It sounds very different. And the freshness of the theology says, you know what, this is kind of like I haven't heard this before. It's not the same old, same old. And so people who had grown up bored in church, passing notes, you know, couldn't stand it to save their lives, would never bring a friend, love going to Mosaic, because it still expresses things that they believe, but expresses it in a way that they like, that's really, really fun and cool. Another one is it's for younger ages, right? The average age at Mosaic is about 29, 28 years old, something like that. And so it's a place where people who are in their 20s, early 30s, they fit. These are people like me. And I had one person who said, you know, you just get tired of worshiping with grandparents all the time. And so I know it sounds kind of mean, and I'm sorry, but there are people who were really not saying very nice things about having to be the only 20, you know, one of a few 20-year-olds in a church that was really aged in 50 and 60-year-olds. And so, you know, they would talk about, well, they brought me pie, and we would, you know, and they just talked about it in very, like, nostalgic terms, but they never found friends. And so that became difficult. Well, Mosaic, you got a lot of 20-year-olds. I mean, it's vibrant. And so in coming, you feel connected. And I call this an age haven. This is a place where people my age come. Now you can start to see that every haven has positives and negatives. You know when you say a church is magnetic? Well, it was a friend of mine that said magnetics have a magnet has two poles, right? There's the pole that attracts, but there's the pole that repels. And so every haven of a church attracts and repels. Let's say that you have a haven of a church. You have your choir. You have the hymns. You have sound, doctrinal, exegetical preaching. That haven is for you. Whether you like it or not, it may attract you, but it will repel other people. In the same way that if you walk in or even through the doors, you hear the guitar and the drums. Somebody goes, "Hey, I'll stand up and worship!" You know, you may just turn around and go back in the car, right? Because that's like, no thank you, you know. And they'll say, "We do hymns, come in, great, come in." You know, they just go for it. They do the hymns, but they don't do it in a way that is your hymn, right? Right? Not for you. Right? So you pay a price. And the thing that I want to say here is that every church pays a price for its haven. See? And this is where it gets really tricky to go, how do you attract every... You know, we say... Because nowadays, if you say, who are you trying to reach? And they'll say, we're trying to reach everybody. You know, we're trying to reach everyone. We're trying to reach all of Grand Rapids, you know, Western Michigan. That's us, you know, and they'll be very bold about who they're trying to reach. Not true. Not going to happen. Not going to happen. You can just look around and see the 250 people and say, not going to happen. Okay? But what you can do is go, okay, what is it that people are coming for? Okay? And so the younger ages at Mosaic's embrace of change, accentuation of artistry, and they avoid ethnic enclaves, which is interesting. So let me tell you a moment, and then I'll go back and tell you a moment more on havens and how it relates to racial diversity. At Mosaic, there are a handful of first-generation immigrants. Okay? The people who come, who are diverse, are people who have lost the original language. You know, they don't really know. You know, they may be Korean, but they don't know how to talk Korean. They don't know how to cook Korean. They don't eat Korean, you know. They are ethnic in name and label by heritage, but not by practice, okay? So I'm Cuban, right? But I can't dance, right? I don't smoke cigars, you know. There are a lot of things that I love Cuban food, but there's really very little. And I've had so many experiences. I hope it doesn't happen again soon, but people say, "Oh, you're Cuban? Let me introduce you." And say, "Alejandro, come." He'll start, you know, and so we'll start talking a little. And then after about, it only takes about 2 minutes now. It used to be at least 5 minutes, but now it's 2. And Alejandro will look at me and goes, "You're not really Cuban, are you?" And I'm not, you know. So it's that at Mosaic, it's a place where you can be ethnic without having to act ethnic. Yes?
Have you worked with any churches that have first generation? Multicultural first generation?
Yes, but let me still move just a step or two, and then I will go back there. Here you have a sense of one of the reasons that Mosaic works is because people are part of the acculturated middle, okay? And the appeal to popular culture works well at Mosaic because second-generation immigrants, their culture is popular culture, okay? And I want to tell you that one of the things, please don't lose your question, but when you walk into a church that's a very traditional building, it is stepping back in time. And for a person who is an immigrant, even a son or daughter of an immigrant, when you come in, you feel like you're walking into a uniquely American past, okay? Because pews don't exist anywhere but in traditional churches, right? And so you go, this, it looks more like a museum, okay? And so in that sense, when you move in there, you have to make a conscientious cultural leap in order to be a part of that church. Okay? And that's why you can criticize it all you want. But today, as a sociologist, I'm telling you that if a church looks more like the mall, if a church looks more like a movie theater, it is because it resonates with what their life experience is. These are what the kinds of buildings that we study in, work in, play in. This is what we do. And this is not untrue of Christianity. It's that we forgot it. Because the original structure of the church emerged out of the public buildings, marketplace, and civic buildings of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire was called a Byzantium or something. It became the Byzantine Church. It became what we know as a cathedral. The cathedral as we know it today, and other facets of it, grew out of a particular civic building, civic architecture, that was then used for sacred purposes. So in terms of going into a warehouse and using it for church, you may go, gosh, you know, it doesn't look like it, doesn't feel like a church. Go to a nightclub. Mosaic uses a nightclub on Sunday night. Gosh, you know, this isn't really a church. It is. It is to them. Because the church isn't embedded in the building. It is back to our old theology that says the church is people. A lot of people don't really believe that. But if the church is really people, then you can make any building work. Because that building houses the ecclesia and what they do. Yes, ma'am.
One of your bullets here, you write that it accents artistry. What do they do there, and then how does that reflect the culture of it?
Yes, very briefly, and the book pursues it a great deal more, but there is not only music and in the worship in terms of original songs, original music. There's also an incorporation of dance. There's an incorporation of graphic imagery. There are short documentary films, short films that are done. There are sculpting that's done during the service. There's painting that's done during the service. And then there are a lot of other ways that it reflects that, both during and after the services. I describe a service that was where the entire service was reconstructed into a game board. And so what happened in the service depended on the roll of a giant die on the stage. And so according to the die, something was invoked in the service. And so those kinds of things of a creating of an ambiance, of having a theme, let's say of earth or wind or fire, and having the entire building all the way, even stretching into the parking lot, reconfigured to reflect fire and what that would mean metaphorically for the study of Scripture that day. I explore that a great deal. When you come in, you go, wow, this place values the arts. So here's a great entry to this. I come to this church because I didn't know Christian artists existed. And that's cool. So, we find people who are Asian, Hispanic, and white who come not because they're looking for diversity. They're looking for something that they value in themselves. And what they value is they're actors, they're dance professionals, they're graphic artists, they're architectural designers. And they see a church that values something that they value in themselves, and they build affinities on that basis. So what Mosaic has done well, and what I argue in this book, is that I discern five havens. Maybe there are more, maybe there, you know, whatever. But for me, I've said there are five havens, and those five havens create affinities. And those affinities are part of a person's identity, but they are not solely oriented around race or ethnicity. And so a person can be an artist and join with other artists, even if they're of a different race or ethnicity.
Are we back somewhat to the homogeneous unit principle, but not with respect to ethnicity or economic status?
Yes, yes, and I expected that, so I appreciate that. The difference, if there's any, that's here, is that these were a little more organic than a marketing intention. There were no flyers sent out saying, if you're an artist, we want you. You know, it was organic in stimulating the interests and passions of people who were already coming in the congregation. And so out of stimulating the missional enterprise of each person, then it started to elicit interesting kinds of ministries. So instead of being top down, it became a little bit bubbling up from the bottom. And so then out of that, the ministry with its value for relationships said, let's create ministries out of relationships that people have. And so now as a sociologist, I come back and I say, these I think are particular affinities that emerge out of havens. It's not exactly the marketing scheme, because you have to understand the context of people's life experience to say, who's coming and why? Where are people coming from? What is it that they're resonating with? And that resonance is very different from a slick marketing program that says, we know these people are moving in here, we need to reach, you know, Fortune 500 company officers kind of thing. That's a little bit different. Okay, so very good. Then the second thing related to that is that the church, more than this, is accentuating a new common identity as a dedicated follower of Jesus Christ. And so everyone here talks about themselves as a passionate follower of Jesus. These places as havens become a place to be molded and shaped into the core values of the congregation. So if you're an artist, you come in, you find out, oh, look at all this artistry. You may become a part of a drama group. And in being part of the drama group, you become more and more immersed in the core of the congregation. And the core of the congregation begins to forge relationships. And those relationships then create a sense of, this is who we all are. And that's what allows artists, and maybe, you know, could be that not everybody shares all these, right? There are older people at Mosaic. They're not a part of the age haven. But they may very much embrace change. They may be people who love change, really want to see the world happen. They want to be a part of seeing things happen. And so they'll embrace that haven and then join with everyone else on the basis of that common identity. At Oasis, it's very similar. And at Oasis, the similarity is that everyone there is working in the entertainment industry, the Hollywood entertainment industry. It gave me an opportunity to talk a lot about Christianity in Hollywood. But within that, there's a lot of struggle, there's a lot of issues. What does it mean to be a dedicated, faithful person who's still pursuing still pursuing fame? And in doing so, they forged this really interesting, supportive network with each other. Now, in terms of a question of people who, churches that have indigenous groups, I think the example that I think of right now are groups that have, who are assimilated into a church. And so let me talk about it this way. Whatever your church is, whatever it does, so this is, oh, you can't see, it's just a box. It's not very sophisticated. I'll draw my box over here. All right, there you go. So you weren't missing much. All right, so this is a box. This is your church. All right. People on the outside don't know what's going on in your box. Now, what determines what people go to church? Okay. Studies show basically it's who you're married to, who your parents are, who your kids are. That's basically how you know dominantly. If it's not that, then it's who brings you, right? It's going to be a friend. Some kind of connection. When a person gets introduced into your box, that's how they begin to define what church is. Okay. And so what I find is that people learn how to worship, learn, you know, how you do church in whatever place they happen to have fit in. I can't always explain how this happens. I can't explain the arrow. What I can explain is that when I approach these people and I ask them, tell me about your worship, you know, what kind of worship music do you have? They say, it's worship music. Right? And I say, oh, well, what is it? And they say, well, I don't know. And they say, have you heard of it before? No. Do you listen to it anywhere else? No. You know, is it something that, do you like it? Well, you know, they may not even like it. But what they do is they associate the worship of the church with the church, period. And it took me a while to figure this out because I'm the guy who goes to a lot of different churches. See, I've actually been to a lot of churches. Do you know most people in the world have not been to a lot of churches? Most people in the world have been to very, very few churches. And so what they know of church is just the only little bit of experience that they've had. And so they begin to associate whatever church is with the experience that they've had. And so one woman said to me, look, that music is Journey. That's the name of the church. That music is Journey, and Journey is that music. That's it. And that's when I go, aha. People are not conscientiously thinking about the worship music. It's not really a criterion. It's just what they understand to be a part of this community. And if you're going to be a part of this community, this is how you do it. And so if you're able to successfully bring a few people, then you can see little cadres of strikingly different people being a part of a church. And I saw that in more of a high liturgy church in Los Angeles in particular, where I was surprised to find a group of blacks, but they were, many of them had moved from Africa directly. And so there was a small community that had been established. These were not then American-born blacks, right? These are African blacks who had come and now live there. And so they formed a sort of cadre. And the church that they were part of is just the church that they knew. It just, it. That was it. Not maybe what you want to hear, but it is that. So, here's the thing. When you have racial and ethnic diversity, do you have cultural difference? Not necessarily. Not necessarily. At Oasis, there was a common struggles among Hollywood entertainment industry workers. And so what I found is that when I spoke to whites and when I spoke to blacks in the church, they were younger blacks, upwardly mobile or middle class, trying to make it in the industry. They spoke of their lives in the same way. They talked about their issues and struggles in similar ways. And so it would be a mistake to put a white actor and a black actor living in LA trying to make it and say, on the basis of race, these people are so different. How can we bridge this difference? They don't see that difference. They don't act on that difference. And so out of their common life circumstance, they're actually culturally very similar. That is not common sense for most people. And so it's helpful to us because what happens with good-natured people like yourselves is that we say, oh, we have to bridge the difference, you know? How can we reach out to people who are so different from us? And so in terms of the strategy for cultural diversity, we tend to say, who is the most different person in this city? Oh, there are these new refugees who have moved in. Let's go have an outreach over there. And so we decide to do an outreach with the most culturally distant people in the hope that somehow that's going to be like some kind of cultural elastic that will somehow incorporate more diversity into our church. Doesn't work. It doesn't work. Because what we ignore are, when I go to the PTA meetings, there are lots of people here in the PTA meetings. There is probably some diversity already in your PTA diversity. I dare say that there's more diversity in your PTA meetings than there is in your church services. Who should you be talking to? The moms and dads at the PTA. Who shops at your grocery store? We know that the grocery store is far more diverse than your church service. Right? So who should we be talking to? What I'm saying is that our common life experiences have diversity within them. But it's that we are so closed into our little things, you know, that we won't talk to people. We won't even talk to people next to us. And then we instead set up a committee to be highly intentional to create this grand program and spend money for something that can do good. So I don't want to say don't do that. What I'm saying, is that a strategy for enhancing the diversity of your church? No. Is it a great ministry? Yes. Is it a strategy for cultural and ethnic diversity of the church? No. Yes, sir.
It seems to me, though, that there are two kind of working definitions of church. In the box used over there,
yeah,
on the side, it's largely based on the worship setting and the experience of church as a worship. Over here, though, and what you have on the screen,
yeah,
it's an experience that is outside of that worship that brings them together for worship.
Yeah.
So the church experience is a broader definition than what it is within the box.
I would agree with you. The reason that I emphasize this for now is because the corporate assembly is a visible witness to the diversity of your church. So while you're absolutely correct in saying that we would make a mistake to define our church as what happens in that hour, so you're absolutely right. I'm with you. Theologically, morally, personally, sociologically. The church is broader. Yet, we look at this because this becomes a visible and most intentional expression of who we are. And what happens in that service matters more than we think. But it just may matter in ways that we don't anticipate, you know, that we really don't expect. I hope that's helpful.
Well, if I look at where the cultural distance, it's happening on that Sunday morning hour where there seems to be the biggest distance and biggest gap that we're trying to overcome.
Perhaps.
During the week, though, uh-huh, you know, I look at my own congregation, which is probably 99% Caucasian.
There. Right.
But during the week, it's not. It's quite diverse during the week. It's just that Sunday morning worship hasn't.
I see. So you're saying that somehow these your church or your church's ministries have a lot, but these people are not shared into a common. Okay.
A common worship site.
I see.
And the guys, you know, I think through some of the bat, like our basketball night, we have basketball night.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
A lot of relationships.
That's a great example.
There are guys who come there who don't go to any church for a worship setting, and they view
Agreed.
Our church as this is my church.
Agreed. So what here, and this may be much further in our dialogue, but here I'm assuming that church is trying to produce, you know, there are people who come in, but there's something that's coming out. And in my way of thinking, the most fundamental thing that a church does is it produces a certain type of person. So as long as the ministries of the church have a number of things going on, that's of course a part of a wonderful and healthy ministry. But the question to me is, are we creating a unified assembly that is after a common mission, common goals, share a common identity? And so while there are people, we have tons, I mean, I can very much see, yeah, that's my church, you know, but they're clearly not a part of your church in the sense I'm talking about sociologically, because they're actually not a part of the values and the mission and the goals that you're working towards together. They're not following the leadership and authority of the church in any manner. They're not contributing towards the expansion or the building of that church. And so, in this sense, perhaps it's a more theological definition. It's more closely tied to what I understand as the ecclesia and not just a nominal statement of involvement. But I also accept that all those things are the base from which diversity can happen for the communal body that's moving together. I understand not everybody would agree with me necessarily on that, but that would be my move. Yes, sir?
My question, I'm just following what you said.
Yes.
How can we integrate the people coming during the week in our church,
right,
in our community dinner? When they are in trouble, they come to us to ask for money. How can we integrate them in our congregation?
Very good.
Come and worship with us.
Very good. I'll give you a few things, and then let's see where we go. It does fit into my next point. I didn't pay you to do that, Jane. First of all, churches that are successfully multiracial do have what I call racial presence. Now, I want to be careful with the word race. So racial, ethnic, I mean difference. There's visible difference. That difference is accentuated. And so at Oasis, it's accomplished by talking about racial issues. At Oasis, it also does incorporate musical preferences and tastes. They move more towards an R&B, funk, gospel style. And they have staff leadership that's diversified. Okay? So what you have is people see difference. And I think that I've seen this often enough that I would say that this is a characteristic of churches that have that diversity. And this is where I understand that we do not want tokenism. Mere tokenism, meaning that we just put someone up there because they're different. We do want a vibrant expression of the life, but at the same time we shouldn't avoid people who are a part of our congregation who can be a part of that if they can. And so in that sense we stimulate leadership, we stimulate presence, and the churches that I've seen, enough of them do it intentionally that's something worth noting. Okay, so even if you've only got those few should be made more to the center of your church. I mean, this is a question. If you have racial presence in the pew, so to speak, but no racial presence on the platform, does that say something about your church? Is there something about your church that's consistently and systematically marginalizing those who are not of your mainstream? And if that's true, then there are corrections that need to be made in your ministry so that those people are a part, a central part of your ministry and have a legitimate place on your pulpit, not just because they're different in color or ethnicity.
What if the person of color is comfortable with, say, their position in a congregation and that, so he has, you know, positioned in a place of leadership?
That's right. And see, this is where Mosaic and Oasis, I think that even though they are intentional about racial presence, they don't try to get people in only to promote diversity. See, I think that I would feel devalued if I say, oh, you're the only Hispanic we got, you're not much of one, but we'll take you. So would you come up and read some scripture, you know, or read it in Spanish? I would be insulted. Why? Because the complexity of who I am, and also what we say are the deeper values of our church, which is that I'm a follower of Christ, are being violated. If instead you say, Gerardo, we really appreciate your passion, would you come and do this? Then yes, I'll do that. Why? Because I'm being called on for the thing that I value, why I'm here. So I could see resistance if it's a programmatic basis. I think that I can assume that there would be less resistance if it has to do with the things that we are as a community. Yes, sir.
So piggybacking on that.
Sure.
I often wonder, because I've been a past church I was in, that we as people of color, sometimes we need to forego just being comfortable and be more intentional of stepping to the forefront of that.
I think that that's true.
It's not going to happen because we're just comfortable, then it's not going to happen.
Right, and that's where the churches, particularly here at Mosaic, I think that Mosaic is really quite good at this. It's good at making everyone intentional. And so what it does is it says, whoever you are, God can use that. And so that's where God can use you as an artist, God can use you as a woman, God can use you as, you know, Mexican-American, even if you're fifth generation Mexican-American. And so in that sense, we start to see that all of us can be used in multiple ways. And if we begin to encourage and stimulate that creativity, then we can see something going on. Well, let me show you one other thing. Another thing is to avoid exaggerating differences. We can head into trouble when we see worship as timeless and historical. We need to appreciate the richness of local context. I've talked about havens, and that would be an interesting exercise for you, to allow people to create new communities around the affinities and values that they already share. The idea here is that identity is multi-layered. And so seek to attract people on the basis of things that cross racial and ethnic lines, rather than trying to establish homogeneous sub-ministries within your church. Okay. All right, and then intentionality. You can't change your context, but you can't change your attitude. All right. And so from here, we're saying become aware of the diversity already around you, and even a person like myself, I may not be, I'm not as brown as I could be, I'm not as, you know, I don't have an accent, those kinds of things. But I'm probably going to be more effective at being able to touch a few more Hispanics who are more culturally distant than some of my white friends. And so by successfully working with and attracting those who are a half step away, you provide the resources for your churches to take that other half step. That's where I'm going to stop. I'm sure that there's a lot more that we could discuss. It's an endless topic, and I have more in my other session. But if you're open, we can all have lunch and be happy to talk more. Thank you so much.